intervene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. For our third case for today, 03-0580, Phelps versus Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin, arguing on behalf of Mr. Phelps et al. Is William Cannon, and then I have attorney Michael Van Sicklin arguing 15 minutes for Physicians Insurance. Attorney John S. Skilton arguing for 15 minutes for the Physicians Insurance, and then Mr. Cannon, you in rebuttal. 5 minutes. You may proceed.
May it please the court, Mr. and Mrs. Phelps, who are present in court and counsel. There are five issues that are before this court based on the briefs submitted. The first issue is the issue of whether or not the jury trial was waived by the failure to timely pay the jury fee and the failure to properly move for an enlargement of time showing excusable neglect, and also whether or not the reason for the nonpayment constituted excusable neglect under the statute and case law. The second issue is what is the applicable standard of care for a first-year unlicensed resident under Wisconsin law, and pursuant to the Johnson case, the Zintec case, and jury instruction 1023, there have only been two classes of physicians, either an average physician or a specialist. An unlicensed physician is a degree of experience. It is not a subspecialty of medicine or an area of medicine, nor is it an area that anyone aspires to. It's simply a degree of experience label. That's all that it is. The third issue is whether or not Dr. Worthington's report should be privileged and thereby protected under the peer review statute 146.38. We submit that he is not an evaluator, nor is he an organization, and all of the information that he compiled was done based on his own investigation, and it was cumulative. Even if you threw out everything, there was more than ample evidence to support the findings of fact of the court. And all the information that was in his report, he told directly to Mr. and Mrs. Phelps. The fourth issue is whether Section 893.55, sub 4, the damage cap, should be extended to include all health care providers, even if they don't meet the 655 definition of a health care provider, which the defendants concede Dr. Lindemann, at page 17 of their brief, did not meet the definition of a physician or health care provider under Chapter 655. And the final issue is whether or not, as a matter of public policy, the loss of society and companionship damages stemming from their mother's emotional distress injuries are too remote, in spite of case law under Thiama, Bell, and more recently in Pierce, that clearly allow for those kinds of damages. The only basis for reversal by the Court of Appeals was the jury fee waiver issue. The other determinations are issues raised as a result of decisions contained within the Court of Appeals opinion. I think if I can, in less than 2 minutes, give you
Excuse me, Counselor, just so I'm sure that I'm clear on the facts. Didn't the Court of Appeals say that the trial court used both standards, the standard that the patient might require given the presentation medically, and then the standard of the level of training of the physician?
Yes, the court did find that based on the evidence, and I think that's a significant point, because the defendant, Dr. Lindemann, hired two expert witnesses, Dr. Brookhazen and Dr. Stephen Clark, to testify, and they both testified that under even the first year standard of care issue, Dr. Lindemann was negligent for failing to consult the senior resident or the attending physician. So that's why Judge Sullivan found that he was negligent under both standards of care. Dr. Baer, the treating physician, Dr. Worthington, who investigated, and Dr. Acker, my expert witness, who's the chairman of the Department of Obstetrics at Harvard, all testified that Dr. Lindemann was negligent. So there were, both standards were violated. The court found that both standards were violated, and there was testimony that both standards were violated.
But wasn't that a problem? Didn't the Court of Appeals see that as a problem and then being able to properly allocate negligence between the physician and the hospital?
Yeah, I found that somewhat curious because that was simply an argument thrown out without any citation of authority that somehow if the court would have applied a different standard, there would have been a different result. But the test is, of course, whether or not there's any evidence to support the finding of the court in the record, number one. But number two, the expert, Dr. Clark, wrote a report and testified that Dr. Lindemann gave completely inadequate care to Mrs. Phelps, but that completely inadequate care met the standard of care. In essence, he said, there is no standard, there is no objective standard, and any time a resident does something wrong, mistakes are expected and anticipated, and therefore when it happens, he even meets the standard of care by, in essence, being negligent. That shifts the burden of mistakes to the patient. It allows the doctor to practice and make free mistakes on the patient. The policy of the state has long been expressed in having a public policy of providing quality health care from Kishishian on. That's why we impose liability to give health care providers and hospitals the incentive to make sure that they provide quality health care. The standard that the defendant sought to introduce is borders on ludicrous. It's an extreme standard that this court should never countenance.
Mr. Cannon, I'd like to clear up something in my own mind also. Did the children recover here just for loss of society and companionship in regard to the mother, or was there a recovery in regard to the father also?
No, it was for the mother only. It was the loss of society and companionship award for the mother's emotional injuries in this case, and it was a modest award of $45,000 for each child. That's an interesting issue that you raised, because the facts of this case are so horrific that there can be no doubt that the mother sustained a severe emotional injury in this case. And even in Pierce, without a showing, she was awarded a separate cause of action for emotional distress injuries. And in this case, there was a physical finding of fact by Judge Sullivan of the nausea, the diarrhea, the sleepless nights, the nightmares that she sustained, and there was expert evidence by a Dr. Mounts who testified that she sustained a permanent emotional injury, and her husband did in this case. So we've met every criteria that could possibly be met based on the prior rulings of this court.
You know, I'm glad you brought up the husband's injury, because it perplexed me just a little bit, having just been part of Pierce, which came out a very short time ago, and I want to know, what is the basis for his recovery?
Well, if a bystander under Bowen can collect emotional distress injuries and a participant in Pierce can collect emotional distress injuries, the husband qualifies under both. He was actually...
He wasn't a participant. He wasn't giving birth to this child, at least under our term in Pierce. We were very clear that was not a bystander injury, that was a participatory injury. And that's why the mother prevailed in Pierce to bring her claim to the trial court.
Well, if we go back to the case where the police car was, I think it's Garrity, chasing the young girl.
Right.
In this case, Mr. Phelps was on the phone with his wife from about 3 o'clock in the morning until he could find a babysitter for his other daughter. He then went to the hospital, arriving there at 6:30 in the morning. His wife, Marlene, said that she felt the urge to defecate and asked for his assistance to put her on the commode next to her bed because she couldn't even walk to the bathroom. At 6:45, he assisted her in getting her out of bed, placing her on the commode, drawing the curtains, and she remained there from 6:50 until 7 o'clock because she was told to not strain, to just let gravity take its course. And at 7 o'clock, approximately, this is what she testified to.
Yeah, I read your briefs. I know that she felt a foot, and having two children of my own, I understand exactly what was going on.
Okay. She felt a foot, and she then called her husband, who came over and looked down and saw it and verified. He ran for help then and brought Dr. Pearson in, who happened to just be walking along in the hallway. And then he
Are you claiming he's a bystander counselor? Is that your claim? I mean, what is your claim for him? I'm not understanding it well.
He qualifies under either. I think this is a slight extension of Pierce, but don't forget this is not a Chapter 655 case. And he also qualifies under Garrity and under the Bowen case. The Bowen case, the mother came upon the scene after it happened, and I think it was 20 or 30 minutes after the accident happened. Her child was dead. In this case, Mr. Phelps was there and actually saw his child die. The child came out leg first. He actually saw Dr. Pearson pull the baby out vaginally. The baby was dead. This is more of a Bowen case than Bowen is.
Is that issue before us?
No, it's not even before this court. It was not raised as an issue on appeal. And it was none of the facts, none of the evidence are in dispute here, and they aren't contesting any of it. All of their legal issues on appeal are just that, legal issues, but that is one issue that they did not raise.
What do you want this court to do?
Editor.
What's your next choice?
That's not raised on appeal.
Counsel, is that issue before us?
Unfortunately, no. What I would like this court to do is to reverse the Court of Appeals on the finding that there was excusable neglect based on the failure of Dr. Lindemann to timely move for enlargement of time. They waited 15 months. There's already a case and where 15 weeks, 14 weeks where it was found to be not excusable neglect to move for enlargement of time. And also the testimony of Mr. Peterson, who is a fine lawyer, but he did not meet the test required under Headkey. He basically said that we have, if I can just go to the chronology here that we have, on July 10th, he and Mary Wolverton were handling this case from his firm. They both attended the schedule conference. Mr. Peterson, by phone, he was in Philadelphia. The court set a jury fee deadline for September 1, and Mr. Peterson says nothing more than, at the end of August, I became ill and later found out that it was kidney cancer. Yet the record in this case shows that on September 5, he participated in a 3.5-hour deposition of Dr. Baer, the obstetrician for Mrs. Phelps. So he obviously was not incapacitated there. The Court of Appeals went beyond their error-correcting authority and decided to find facts but didn't look in the record to see what the test was, which is Hepke. And they clearly didn't meet the Headkey test of moving in a timely fashion to enlarge time, nor did the testimony of Mr. Peterson meet the test set out in Headkey. In Headkey, if you'll recall, the defense attorney in that case didn't timely file an answer to the complaint, and I think he was just about a week or so late. And his excuse to the trial court was that he was immediately prior to the commencement of the trial, he was out of town taking depositions in Los Angeles. He was involved in another trial. This court held that's not sufficiently specific. And in Headkey, citing the Mills versus Ray case, you held that an enlargement of time will be allowed after the time has run only when the initial failure to do the act was the result of excusable neglect and there has been no inexcusable delay in moving for enlargement.
Mr. Cannon, I'm looking at Section 805.03 of the statutes. I didn't see that cited in your brief. which says for failure of any claimant to prosecute or for failure of any party to comply with the statutes governing procedure in civil actions or to obey any order of court. The court in which the action is pending may make such orders in regard to the failure as are just, including but not limited to orders authorized under Section 80412, sub 2A. When I read that statute, I want to make sure I'm not missing something. I'm wondering why you didn't pursue that.
Well, I'll tell you, it's very interesting. When Mr. Peterson showed up on the first day of trial, there was no notice to us. The court had made its rulings. We were showing up to try the case starting at 9 o'clock that morning. And as we're getting ready to start the trial, Mr. Peterson walks into the courtroom. So there was no notice of motion, no motion to shorten the time to hear a motion. And he gets on the stand and gives this testimony. I knew under Hebke that he didn't meet the prima facie showing required under Hebke, and I also knew that his statement didn't meet an excusable neglect statement. The burden is on him to do it. I thought as a matter of judgment that I was confident that he didn't meet the test and there was no need to pursue it any further. So we would like the court to reverse the Court of Appeals on the jury waiver issue. We would like this court to affirm the trial court holdings in all other respects.
Counsel, when we review the decision that you're asking us to look at by the trial court, we have to see whether the court erroneously exercised his discretion. So though I understand your arguments, what I find myself doing is going back and looking at the record and what the trial court say, and what was the standard he applied. And I have to tell you, I'm a little troubled that he didn't apply the correct standard of law regardless of what was in front of him, and I understand your concerns about what was in front of him. What do you have to say about that? It seemed to me what he said is, this is a real complicated case. Hey, we're in December. It's getting close to Christmas. I'm never going to get this done if I don't take care of it, so I'm going to do it. I didn't see him apply the standard that, A, they didn't show excusable neglect, or, B, they didn't move in a reasonable time.
I think the court did. As you are well aware, in the Thorpe versus Town of Lebanon case, which is 225 was second 672, the court held there, the court need not use the term excusable neglect in the analysis. What is critical is that the court explain its analysis and that its analysis is reasonable. And you can also make that finding implicit in the court's analysis under the Chitwood versus A.O. Smith Harvest Store case. In this case, what we have is a situation where the court, no jury fee had been paid timely. It was automatically waived. The court made a decision that it's going to be tried to the court. There were no jurors now that would become available at a last minute like that. There was a certainty that we were now going to be delayed several days from getting to our expert witnesses, and they might not even be able to show up because of the holiday season. That would necessitate an adjournment. This case, the facts arose in 1998. We're now in 2002 at this trial, and quite frankly, with the trial schedules of the defense counsel and myself, we would have probably been lucky to get a jury trial the following summer or fall. And I think that the court made a decision that the case has gone on long enough. We had a lot of motions in this case and a ton of discovery, and that the parties were entitled to get that day in court without any further delay. And I think with the issues that were being raised, these are new issues when the court is confronted with a proposal by the defendants that completely inadequate care meets the standard of care. That is so subject to being such a prejudicial issue in front of a jury that I think the court wisely exercised discretion. I think that every lawyer in this case respected the trial skills, fairness, and experience and expertise of Judge Sullivan. I think he's actually tried more jury trials than any judge in the state. So the issue wasn't a fair trial here. He gave everybody a fair trial.
No, that wasn't my concern. My concern was whether he used the proper standard to exercise his discretion, which is to say there was no excusable neglect, or in the interest of justice, this matter had to go forward if he did find excusable neglect.
Yeah, but the defendants, don't forget, never met the standard for establishing excusable neglect. What was the delay in 15 weeks waiting to bring a motion without notice to the plaintiffs to have the jury fee paid?
Well, perhaps they thought you weren't going to mind that they paid it 7 working days late way back in September, and they thought you were counting on a jury trial just like they were counting
on a
jury trial.
Well, if they had notified me that they had paid it, it wouldn't have been an issue had they probably moved early on and complied with the Hetke case and complied with Statute 801.15.2a, but they didn't. And this Court has held in Hetke, if you don't do it, in that case, we had a 14-week delay. If you don't do it, you don't get excusable neglect, because you have to show excusable neglect both in the delay in bringing the motion to enlarge time and also the basis for the excusable neglect. And this record already establishes that Attorney Peterson was mistaken in the implicit, not express, but implicit representation to the Court that he became ill in late August. The Court of Appeals interpreted that to mean he was disabled and not working, and that's not the case, because he took a deposition of a key witness, the key witness, the following week. We filed a motion to supplement the record. We don't have a ruling on that, but I think that, as a matter of fact, the information in there clearly establishes that his recollection was faulty when he testified on the first day of trial.
Mr. Cannon, I'm interested in all of your issues, but one of them that I find especially interesting is the standard of care issue. And I wonder if you'd take a couple minutes to address that. I know that Judge Fine, writing for the Court of Appeals, felt that it was significant that Judge Sullivan had said it doesn't make any difference which standard of care is applied. Judge Fine said, wait a minute now, you got an 80% negligence assignment against this doctor, this unlicensed doctor, and it could make a difference whether the standard of care is a higher one or a lower one. What is your response to that?
Well, I think based on the experience of judges on this court who have been trial judges and knowing the standards on negligence and strict liability, for example, if you take the Chart versus General Motors case, where you had two different standards, a negligence standard and a strict liability standard, you just make your findings of negligence. This is not like an Olympic diving contest where you give it a degree of difficulty of 1.5 and multiply it by the initial findings. There is no case in the history of the state of Wisconsin, there is no case that they have cited that said that you now have to weight the evidence dependent on what standard is applied. You just make the assessment, and if a man with Judge Sullivan's experience of well over 500 trials doesn't know how to find negligence and fairly apportion negligence, then I suspect that that's a standard that nobody can meet. But there is no degree of difficulty or weighting of the evidence in Wisconsin law.
Is it fair to say that a fair reading of Judge Sullivan's decision in this case is to the effect that whatever standard of care were to be applied, that 80% would still be the percentage of negligence that he would assign?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think no matter how you cut the cake, it still ends up in the same number of pieces, 80-20, regardless of the standard. They've cited no law on that issue.
Your view is that doctor is held to what standard? Standard of first-year residence?
No.
Standard of a doctor?
He is held to the standard of care of an average physician treating an obstetrical patient. That's the ruling of the Johnson case, and it is also the ruling of the Zintec case. That's the standard that applies. They tried to bootstrap, Dr. Lindemann tried to bootstrap this new standard that has frankly not been recognized anywhere with the exception of Ohio. It's a Rush versus Akron case, 1957, where they applied apparently some lower standard of care under similar circumstances. But Jenkins, which is also an Ohio case, 1982, held them to the same standard of care. They then cited Sullins, which is an unpublished Ohio decision and has no validity here. But the cases from Wisconsin and other jurisdictions, the McBride case, the Jenkins case that I mentioned, and the Register and San Germán case, all hold residents to the standard of care of an average physician. First-year resident, second-year resident, third-year residents are all descriptive labels of their years of experience. It's not a measure of any specialty of medicine. That's all it is. So 1023 has recognized only two standards of care.
Counselor, does the hospital have any different obligation when it sets up a medical resident to be the kind of line of first defense that this doctor was with more experienced people in the wings? Do they have any different obligation for him than they would, say, Dr. Baer, who was her treating physician?
Actually, had the policies and procedures, the answer to that question is no, but had the policies and procedures been followed here, Dr. Lindemann would not have treated. The testimony in this case unanimously was that Dr. Lindemann was supposed to assess and report. By the time he treated Mrs. Phelps, he had treated over 400 obstetrical patients at Maricare General Hospital while he was in medical school. He knew the chain of command. You'd go to an upper-level licensed senior resident, and then you go to the treating physician if there's not resolution. He had completed his rotation at St. Mary's Hospital in obstetrics and now was on the second round of rotation. The policies and procedures were known to him, understood by him. You know, it's like hiring a security guard to watch your house, and the security guard sees smoke, smells smoke, sees flames, and then decides to fall asleep and not dial 911. This is not a complex medical malpractice decision. This is simply common sense. You go and you get help. He made the correct diagnosis. Actually, his diagnosis that he wrote in the records and testified to was abruption or the start of labor. And so he made the correct diagnosis, and then he did nothing about it and actually told Mrs. Phelps, and it's in the record, that he was going to go consult with an upper-level resident, senior resident. Then he never did anything. He fell asleep. So this is a common sense issue. This is not a complex medical case. And had he done what he had been trained to do, taught to do, knew what he was supposed to do, assess and report, and consult a senior resident or Dr. Baer, who actually was in the hospital at the time of this event, we wouldn't be sitting here today.
Could I ask a couple of fact questions, Mr. Cannon? How does a resident earn a living during the time that he or she is a resident? Is he or she paid by somebody?
Yeah, they're paid by the MCWA. That's an acronym for Medical College of Wisconsin Affiliated Hospitals. All of the residents are employed by MCWA. They have to follow the policies and procedures that MCWA enacts and also the policies and procedures at the institutions, just like when I come here, I have to follow your policies and procedures here at the Milwaukee County Courthouse, but that doesn't make me your employee or an employee of Milwaukee County. And so MCWA has the right to hire and the right to fire, and they do the actual paying of the resident, and they provide the liability insurance for Dr. Lindemann.
Is there some sort of payment for these residents to the compensation fund?
No. It's never anticipated that the residents would be providing hands-on care because they're always supposed to do it in consultation with a senior resident or the treating physician in their first year. And in the second and third year, then you go up the chain to the treating physician directly. So he had the right to go directly to the senior resident or to call Dr. Baer, and he didn't do that. But he's not supposed to. He had no privileges, and he admitted it in his deposition and at trial, that he could not treat Mrs. Phelps. He had no privileges because she was a breech presentation, high-risk twins. One twin had a breech presentation, leg first. You can't be born leg first and survive. And there was also a placental
placenta previa, which means the placenta covered the vaginal opening, which means that she could only give birth by a C-section. He had no authority and no staff privileges. He wasn't on the staff at St. Joe's. So he knew he couldn't treat her. So he did nothing. He violated the common sense policies and procedures. This is about in as egregious a case as you can get, and I would submit that since every doctor, even his own experts who testified in this case, testified that he was causally negligent, all these other issues are really, you know, they go by the board. This court could find as a matter of law on these facts there was no defense, and there wasn't, as a matter of fact. I think Judge Sullivan at one point said, Mr. Cannon, if you're going to put in any more evidence on negligence, I'm going to have to throw a penalty at you for piling on. And it was a very weak defense, and even they couldn't withstand common sense cross-examination about what Dr. Lindemann knew or should have known, because every one of them has gone through and trained residents, and at every institution in this country, there's a chain of command. You assess and you report as first year, you don't treat, and you get others involved. It's that simple. This is a lady who is writhing in pain, and what did he do? Illegally, he gave her a narcotic, Demerol, to knock her out, to stop her from complaining. I mean, that's indefensible. He has no legal authority under state law to prescribe a narcotic, but he did it. And this is really an outrageous case.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Cannon.
Thank you.
Mr. Van Sicklin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. As you know, I'm Mike Van Sicklin. It's the pleasure of Mr. Skilton and I to represent, as co-counsel, the health care providers here. I have the daunting task of trying to cover 4 of the 5 issues that Mr. Cannon outlined. I'm going to address, hopefully in the following order, subject to questions, the jury trial issue, the standard of care issue. I'm going to spend the most time on those first two. Then I'm also going to address briefly the peer review question, and then the question on non-economic damages, both as to the parents and the two siblings. Mr. Skilton is going to address, finally, the question of Dr. Lindemann's status as a health care provider under Section 893.55. And we've agreed in advance that if I need to borrow a few minutes of his time, that I could do so given the number of questions I have here. So on the jury trial, we submit that the trial court's ruling here denied Dr. Lindemann's fundamental right to a jury trial in 2 independent respects, both of which are reversible error. And, of course, the Court of Appeals only addressed 1 of those 2 grounds. But the 2 grounds are that it violated his right to a jury trial under 805.01, which protects and limits the way in which you can waive your entitlement to a jury trial. Secondly, we view the trial court decision as violating the mandate that you issued in Headke for the procedure for handling excusable neglect cases. Now, as it did in the Chitwood case, the Court of Appeals did not address the first issue, that is, the significance of the statutory codification of the constitutional right under 805.01, and instead addressed the excusable neglect issue. I'm just going to briefly outline and clarify why we think that first issue is important and then get to the Headke issue. Under 805.01, where the demand is timely, which was the case here, it's our position that the late payment of a fee cannot constitute waiver. There's a lot of finger-pointing here in the briefs back and forth about whether we should have copied plaintiff's counsel on the letter that went into the court with the late payment of fees and whether they could have discovered it earlier and the like. But the key undisputed facts is that from the very outset of this case, we made a timely written demand for a jury. It was scheduled as a jury for over a year and a half. It was stipulated and rescheduled as a jury. And the late payment of fees here was made voluntarily without any kind of provoking or prodding, 7 business days late, well a year in advance of the scheduled jury trial.
Mr. Van Sickle, why, as I interpret your argument, I'm having trouble understanding why the trial court would lack the authority to enforce its scheduling order. And I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Cannon. Couldn't the trial court employ 805.03, which would allow for any number of remedies, including dismissal for failure to follow the scheduling order.
I think that's true, Justice. Our point is that every single case that's ever come down in Wisconsin that talked about the waiver of a jury trial right deals with where the demand was either not made at all or was late. There's never been a case like this where it's solely the fee payment that was late. And we submit that if the court truly found fault in the fact that the fee was paid a few days late here, it had lots of other alternative lesser sanctions that would not have been a direct inconsistent result with 80501, which says you can only lose your right to a jury trial in two ways. One, where you fail to make a timely demand, or two, where you as a party stipulate to waive it. Neither of those happen, and we think that the statutorily codified right to a jury that's in our Constitution trumps any kind of a local rule here, and where, as you point out, the trial court had much lesser types of sanctions available to it. There's only three counties in the whole state that have this type of local rule, and we don't think that that local rule should be permitted to trump the statutory guarantee of our constitutional right to a jury. So that's that half of the issue. The second is the head key.
Thus, if someone makes a demand for a jury trial and doesn't ever pay the fee, are they still entitled to a jury trial?
That's a bit more difficult question, and I think that would go really to Justice Butler's question, is if you give a warning and a demand and an ultimatum as a trial judge and they still don't pay it, maybe you can have that harsher sanction at some point.
Except I hear that to be, I mean, as a former trial judge, that sounds right to me, and yet I hear that different than your answer. I heard your answer to be, look, justices, there are only two circumstances in which this sacred right given under our Constitution can be taken away from you. Number one, failure to make a timely demand, and number two, a stipulation. That's what's in our statute, and no local ordinance or other procedure can trump that.
And I think I stand by that argument. I think it's a more difficult question, perhaps, if they never pay the fee, whether you can use that fault or that failure to be a deemed waiver. But it's still, I think, a violation of what the statute provides. The statute doesn't provide that as a waiver. I understand the question, and it's a more troubling situation, but it's not one we have to deal with here. Under Hedke, I think Justice Robinsack put her finger on it, and that is, this is a situation where I don't think reasonable lawyers can really disagree that the trial court did not follow your mandate and how you handle these types of issues. It made no effort to articulate a stated basis for dealing with the reason why the fee was paid late. It also made no effort to articulate a basis for dealing with the criteria that this court laid out in Hedke for the interest of justice.
What about the doctrine of independent review? When we do erroneous exercise of discretion, we have a lot of cases where, or several cases, where the trial court says little, if anything, reaches a result, and our court has said, oh, we go back into the record and make the decision ourselves.
That's exactly what happened in Hedke, Your Honors. You may recall you authored the opinion that the court found that the trial court hadn't followed and articulated the analysis that you deemed appropriate in Hedke. And so you went on and, in your words, ab initio, made those determinations based on the record. And that's exactly what the Court of Appeals did here when Judge Fine did the analysis.
And we can do that ourselves, too.
Correct.
Reach a different result than Judge Fine.
If he can reach it, I don't doubt your power to do so as well.
Just checking.
And I submit that when you do that review, that the right result was reached by the Court of Appeals here, both as to the reason for the delay, that is original trial counsel's kidney cancer. They take fault with that as being an adequate showing because they have some evidence that was never put into the trial court record, never put into the Court of Appeals record that they submitted for the first time in this court, that suggested he was doing at least some other tasks during this period of time. But that wasn't his testimony at the hearing. His testimony was that the fact that he had recently been diagnosed with a serious type of cancer interfered with his practice. He didn't say that I couldn't do anything. And I submit that that's enough of a showing under the cases this Court has articulated dealing with when is doing an act late excusable. And then all of the criteria for the interest of justice strongly support Dr. Lindemann here. There's no basis for finding that he acted in bad faith by having the fee paid late. There's no showing that he somehow got a tactical procedural advantage or was delaying the trial by paying that fee a few days late. Similarly, effectuating his right to a jury trial promotes the important constitutional purpose of a right to a jury trial. And third, there was no prejudice here in that everybody proceeded to this trial believing it was a jury trial. Everybody submitted motions in limine, jury instructions, special verdict forms, and the like. There's no showing of prejudice from effectuating that right. Now, I'd like to turn to the standard of care, because I know that's of interest to a number of you, and particularly Justice Prosser asked about it. We agree with the Court of Appeals that the appropriate focus is on the class that the health care provider is in at the time they provide the service. It's not the class to which they aspire after they're trained, nor is it the class of the highest professional who could have performed the service. And we think that's important. The Phelps concede that there are at least two different possible classes here, a primary care generalist and a board-certified specialist. We submit, though, that that ignores an important difference between those two types of classes and a third class, and that's doctors in training. We all received, or at least I think we did, the ABA journal, and the cover article today was about this Med-Mal crisis. And one of the focuses on the fact that sometimes as lawyers and a legal profession, we don't understand the way medicine's practiced. And I think that's one of the problems here we have on the standard of care issue, because there's an important difference between a doctor in training, every bit as much of a difference there as between a generalist and a specialist. And that is, a doctor in training, like Dr. Lindemann here, cannot provide on his own patient care. He can only provide that care under the direct supervision of a primary attending physician.
But let me ask you this, Mr. Van Sickle. Assume, for sake of your question, that we were to agree with you as a practical matter, given Judge Sullivan's findings that under either standard of care, Dr. Lindemann was negligent, what practical difference does it make in this case? I'm trying to understand why it makes a difference here.
It's a terrific question. I think it's important. There's three problems with the way Judge Sullivan tried to, in my view at least, appeal-proof his decision. But the fact is, before the trial, before the parties decided on how to embark and try their case, he ruled there's only one standard of care, that is of an experienced general licensed physician. But making the decision he did after the fact, there's three problems. One is that the parties here conducted their trial strategy in terms of how to prepare the experts, what types of questions to ask of their witnesses, what offers of evidence they made, believing that the applicable test was the one standard of care, the higher standard, if you will, that Judge Sullivan had directed at the start of the trial. It would change the way this case had been tried, certainly by the defense. Secondly, this 80-20 split, I think, is a very real problem. And the problem is that what was going on here is a comparison between who was negligent as between the doctor in training, Dr. Lindemann, or those who should have been supervising his care at the hospital. We think that, and the third problem is that Judge Sullivan didn't articulate what this other standard of care was that he thought was also breached. He just made a passing comment of it without articulating.
With respect to your second point, and I guess this is what I'm trying to get at, because I'm trying to figure out who benefits here if we accept your proposition. If the trial court found 80-20 negligence at the higher standard, as I understand it, maybe I'm getting it wrong, correct me if I do, the Dr. Lindemann would be then less negligent if you apply the lower standard, and the hospital would be more negligent? That's certainly one. Is that what you're suggesting here?
That's certainly one way it could come out. The other way it could come out, though, is the standards are requiring different things of the two classes of health care providers. Because under our supposition of what this third class should be, that is a doctor in training, the focus is on the oversight that the hospital provided and the oversight by the direct primary attending physician. And the focus on the doctor in training is whether they sought the help they should have sought and so forth. It's not the focus on the type of services they provided. It's a different focus. And so they dismissed out the hospital here, and so it would change the allocation. You would necessarily, I think, in most, if not all cases, have a different split, the 80-20, between the hospital or the attending physician and the doctor in training, depending on which standard you applied. And the proof would be different, and the trial strategy would be different.
Counsel, is there such a thing as a third-year licensed senior resident?
Yes, there's basically 5 years of residency. They differ between types of practice areas and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So is that a doctor in training?
Yes. The way it works, Your Honor, and I had the same question because I don't come from a medical background, is there's really three tiers of doctors in training, and going from the lowest is internists, residents, fellows. But all those different categories of doctors in training cannot practice on their own. They can only work under the direct supervision of someone above them.
This causes me a problem because a part of the idea of putting them in a category is, and in Johnson, the case that discussed that, in part was putting them in a category where they belong vis-a-vis their education, training, responsibility, I suppose. And my guess is that there'd be a huge difference between a first year unlicensed and a fifth year.
Yeah.
And so what you're saying, a first year should be held to the same standard as a fifth year. That's your category is pretty big, isn't it?
Well, interesting, Your Honor, both their allegation and their amended complaint, which is at paragraph 41 of their amended complaint, which is in the record at item number 6, they switched theories here. What they say there was that Dr. Lindemann should be held to the standard of a first-year resident. They don't talk about this other new standard they later articulated. And when you look at the standard of care that's used in Ohio, which is quoted in my brief, I believe at page 29, I think it's a very appropriate one. What it says is for doctors in training, interns, residents, or fellows, the standard of care is that of a doctor of ordinary skill, care, and diligence at the same stage of his or her training under the similar circumstances. And I think that may address your concern.
Is that the standard you want?
I think that's a very workable standard, Your Honor. The question is how fine you parse the classes.
Because not knowing... but my sense is there's a big difference, an awfully big difference in terms of in that category. If the whole idea is to create a new category so that it can be judged commensurate with their abilities, by not nuancing that category, it seems to cover a large span of abilities in practice.
Yeah, I think having three classes certainly brings us closer to reflecting this fundamental difference between somebody that can, work with patients on their own. I think ideally there's nothing wrong, and it's, I think, desirable to fine-tune it a bit by saying for the class that their year of experience or their circumstances and so forth. I think that allows the trier of fact to better analyze whether or not the doctor in training carried out the level of expertise that he or she should have.
This is what's bothering me. They all wear white coats and have a stethoscope sticking out of the pocket?
Yes.
How do I, as the patient, know the difference between somebody who's just come in and is observing because he or she thinks they want to be a doctor? A first year, second year, third year, fourth year, fifth year, or first year fully licensed doctor? I'm the patient. How do I know? Don't they all wear little badges that says doctor, and don't they expect me to call them doctor?
that even first-year residents have the right to be referred to as doctor. They have the right to write prescriptions. But I think your point is why I think this separate classification promotes public policy. What the patient wants is quality care. And what we're saying is that with a doctor in training, the way it works in the medical profession, that quality of care is provided as a team with the doctor in training under the supervision of the primary care provider.
The primary care provider wasn't there. I mean, I know that he was in the hospital, but he wasn't at bedside. So what I got was a first-year person with very little experience. When I'm billed, what am I going to be billed at?
I don't know this particular, you know, situation. I would be very surprised if you wouldn't get billed at a lower rate for the time of the resident. But
I would not be surprised.
It's a package of services. It might be a procedure charge. The policy here, I think, is to encourage the best possible quality of care. And what I think that happens is when you recognize this difference, you encourage the primary care provider in hospital to more directly and attentively oversee and train and mentor that doctor in training. If you leave the doctor in training on their own, you take away the incentive of the primary care provider, the hospital, to oversee that process. I think it's...
Who is the primary? The hospital, or is it the obstetrician that was hired by the family?
I believe it's the individual physician.
And is he a defendant here?
Not presently. So those are strategic choices made by the plaintiff.
So whatever we do doesn't affect him as a practical matter because he's not on the hook.
Right.
So it doesn't change what he may or may not do the next time. And I don't mean malevolence here. We're not talking about that. And he may not have been negligent at all because he... would have no way of knowing, so I don't intend to slur. But if you're going to make the argument that we're trying to improve the system, I don't see how we do it.
Well, I think you do it by what we do here does influence future behavior because it's statewide precedent, and the medical community will be guided by what you do in terms of the standard of care.
Does the standard of care change at all if the resident is licensed or unlicensed? I understand that after a year there could be a license issue. Does that change the standard of care?
Not in our view. I mean, you could make that distinction, but I think the better distinction is on the level of their training and experience. And that's really plays into Mr. Skilton's argument that you should focus on the type of services that the individual is qualified to provide and to what extent they need supervision from the hospital or a primary. The fact of licensing is like, at that point, they've taken certain tests and not others. I don't think that's a critical fact.
Doesn't that say something about experience and ability? If you're licensed, you've taken these tests, and you now have a license?
But what it says is that you're less than a year, year and a half from graduation of medical school, that you've taken two of the three tests that you need, and one of the requirements you still need is to complete 12 months of practical training. That's what it says. And that might be an appropriate distinction as opposed to the doctor in training distinction that I was trying to make. I was searching for the broader class, and I know I'm using a...
May I just ask this? The way I read it and heard you, is the standard of ordinary care at the same stage of development? And I read that as all first-year students, all first-year residents. Are you trying to tell me that you look at this person and say, well, he's below average or above average, so we hold him to a below-average person?
No, not at all.
Okay, so all first-year people are treated the same. That's the standard of care. What is the standard of care expected of a first-year resident? What is the standard of care expected of a second-year resident? Is that what you're...
To say you want to subclassify among doctors in training by year, you would have the expert testimony go to what is it a first-year resident should be doing, what should a second or third-year resident
be doing. I'll tell you the problem I have with that is it seems in some ways unworkable. It seems, and that's what I really heard you saying, and I was trying to get at when I talked about doctors and training, how large was the category. Because if your basis and your response to Justice Crooks was the better standard is based on their level of training and experience, that to me automatically, I hear that as saying, okay, first year are treated differently than second year. Second year differently than third year different than fourth and fifth and fellows. And then if you go that route, then why don't we nuance the average practitioner standard? Someone in the first 5 years of being an average practitioner, or the specialist, someone with double specialty as opposed to single specialty. And, of course, that all leads, in my opinion, to kind of, I might be wrong, but an absurd sort of thing.
On that, maybe you should leave.
Yes.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Do you want to answer that? Who are you speaking about?
I'm
do
sorry.
Do I answer
Would you respond? Would you like to respond to that?
Yes. I mean, do I have time to respond or should
yes.
I sit up? Okay. I don't want to
Would
see
I
my
ask
time.
One question. If one just accepted your proposition of different levels leading to a different standard, doesn't that assume that at each level there are limitations on what a person can do? And when one does things that go beyond those limitations, shouldn't that trigger, or should that trigger, a different standard?
That was the exact issue that Johnson wrestled with, and the question is that should you be measured by the class to which you aspire to be in through training, or should you, I mean, here you could have a board-certified specialist that arguably could do it better than a generalist, who could do it better than a first-year resident. And I think in what the court has held before in Wisconsin is a person should be measured by the class to which they're in. Not these other two possible classes. And if the hospital here, the primary attending physician, permitted the resident to do this, or the resident didn't know better that he or she shouldn't be doing it, then you have a different issue of negligence. But I think the classification issue is most appropriate by focusing on the class they're presently in at the time they do the service. I don't know if that answers your question. But that's why you shouldn't measure when a generalist chooses, as in Johnson, to try to perform a procedure that a specialist perhaps should have or could have better performed. They should still be measured as a generalist.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay, Van Sicklen. Thank you for your generosity and time.
Thank you. Mr. Skilton.
Been sitting so long, I don't know whether I have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
May it please the Court. I'm addressing a relatively discreet issue amongst this legion of issues, and it relates to whether or not this non-licensed first-year resident is a health care provider within the meaning of Section 893.55, 4B and D. And the argument that I have advanced in the briefs and due to you as well is that it's a plain meaning argument, and it flows downhill through the statute from the Clark case. That is to say that the court in Clark versus Erdman used a plain meaning, relying on the Chapter 990 of the statutes, but Hurstian statute construction rules, and found that plain meaning for healthcare provider would include someone other than a 655 defined and limited a person. And in part, that follows from the language of 655 itself, as it expressly begins in this chapter, 655, and then definitions are provided, and they're more like classifications. And I do not contend that a first-year unlicensed resident falls strictly within any of the categories or classifications of 655. But looking at Clark versus Erdman, essentially the court held there that that didn't matter, wasn't instructive on the plain meaning as it relates to that statute. Judge Fine wrote a scholarly opinion and found that the result he came to was anomalous in that he was permitting the same statute to have different definitions of health care provider, but he did so on a concept of inextricably intertwined. That is to say, he looked at other portions of 893.55.4 and found that since Chapter 655 was referenced in those provisions and or the fund was referenced, he felt constrained, therefore, to cross-define, not through the vertical up on the statute, that is to sub 1 of 893.55.1, but rather over to 655 in order to find the definition of health care provider. I think that's essentially what the plaintiffs are arguing here. Now, where I think that the argument has some resonance is in the statutory history. I don't concede it's right because I think plain meaning trumps here, as does Clark versus Erdman. But the statutory history that predated 1995 reenactment of the caps. And in our reply brief, I'm not going to be able to say it as clearly as I want to in a truncated argument. In our reply brief, we outline and specify particularly sub B and sub D and F, the three cap provisions, F being wrongful death, and B and D being the medical claim caps, that relating to health care providers. And in that new legislative history, which I think is crucial to remember, came after the Clark case, after this court broadly defined and challenged, I think, the legislature to do something expressly in the language. It was not Justice Abrahamson's decision, as we wrongly stated in the brief, but it was Justice Steinmetz's decision, but challenged the legislature. If you don't agree with this for one, and of course it was sub one, and that's the statute of limitation, which was remedial. And by the way, this is all consistent, I believe, my argument with the purpose of the statute, and that is to control costs and to keep non-economic damage awards, which are awfully hard to assess, within control. That's all within the fundamental identified Strakowski, et cetera, Morin purposes. But the bottom line is, after that decision in Clark versus Erdman, and in 1995, when the statute was reenacted, the legislative history shows that with respect to the three provisions we are relying on, and most particularly sub B, under Chapter 655 was stricken from the prior language, so that the limitation that one might otherwise have been able to argue by reason of the Judge Fine analysis of inextricably intertwined was affirmatively addressed, I believe, in that legislative history, and indeed the statute was taken to its plain and common meaning. And it's about as simple as that. And in the new statute, the F, that came in that 95 history as well, there you're talking about not the caps on non-economic damages as it relates to wrongful death. The legislative history shows that they considered putting Chapter 655 as a limitation in there, and that was also stricken in the draft, and it comes through without the limitation. So I submit to the Court I've got public policy in terms of the overarching reason in the first instance that these medical malpractice statutes were put in, and then the specific history of this Court's involvement in the construction of the phrase health care provider to broaden it.
Counselor, if he's not a health care provider, then the umbrella policy available to all physicians in Med-Mal doesn't apply to him, correct?
Well,
he has only the insurance that Milwaukee Medical College provides.
I mean, if he's not a health care provider, of course, the issue becomes, is he's an employee of a health care provider.
Yeah, and I saw that in a footnote.
That's a reserved issue.
And nobody briefed it, and opposing counsel made some reference to it, but I understand
it's
that
a reserved issue.
That would only come up if you guys went back down for trial and there are facts that need to be developed. But if in fact, he's not a loaned employee, and he's not a health care provider, then he's got no insurance above whatever the university provides.
This first-year guy who get his license is required by statute to go through this process. In other words, he has to, in order to get that license, and I submit this licensing distinction doesn't make any sense anyway, if it is one at all, and I don't think the court has really bought it.
But he has a permit. He has to have a permit
right.
in order to...
Right, but he's exposed. He's fallen in a crack in the sidewalk. It's a catch-22. We say to these young kids, you go ahead and you do it, because not only you do it, you got to do it. That's how you're going to get your license. And while you're doing it, by the way, you're sitting out there exposed to virtually anything in terms of the kind of damage awards that are available. In fact, you're really a target. It's more than exposed. You're going to design your evidence if you're a smart plaintiff's lawyer and this guy's sitting out there unprotected. Make sure that he gets it big because the non-economic damage cap probably or could possibly not apply if he's...
Well, that's not very good for a plaintiff either because most first-year medical residents have lots of bills and not much money. So you might get a big award, but no money for your client.
Yeah, well, of course, that depends on the underlying insurance issues. And then you get into the question of whether or not it's a health care provider and should be a health care provider and whether the whole health care system is affected by the consequence of this particular issue. I think that the point of the matter is that it is a proper construction to give this first-year unlicensed resident his due, the plain meaning of the statute, to give him the ability to be protected from unlimited non-economic damage recoveries. It's consistent with the kind of public policy that is struck by Justice Rogensack's questions, and it is consistent with Clark versus Erdman, and it is consistent with how the legislature decided to deal with this court's decision in Clark versus Erdman.
Am I correct, however, that he's not covered by the fund?
I think the issue of coverage by the fund is unaddressed in 893. I think that, in my judgment, that's a red herring issue. The question, it reverts to some extent to that which is employee or borrowed employee or whatever. It's layers beyond and not in this case. I do not believe that 893 speaks to the issue that the plaintiffs have identified a concern about.
You don't think that that was at all... within the consideration of the legislature as the legislature was structuring these statutes?
I think the legislature wanted to give this kind of health care provider the protection of the cap. That was its primary drive, to follow Clark versus Erdman. The issue of how 655 functions in terms of what, who pays in and what, and the actuarial determinations and how employees relate or borrowed employees, et cetera, all are dealt with within the strict confines of 655. I would be surprised if the legislature took out some kind of an actuarial calculation as it relates to a first-year residents and tried to figure out whether the fund was paying for it or not. I think it was beyond likely what they were thinking about. What I wouldn't be surprised by is that they said, we want these non-economic caps here to get the benefit of the definition this court gave, the broad, plain meaning definition to that term in the Clark versus Erdman case. That would not surprise me, and I think that's a fair inference. And if it follows from fundamental principles of legislative construction and legislative intent, it talks about plain meaning in the same statute, lining it up. And it doesn't defeat those areas wherein there are cross-references because they simply ride separately. Yes, they're in the statute. Yes, Judge Fine asked me, aren't they in the statute? Yes, they're in the statute, but they are not in the provisions that we are asserting are controlled by the plain meaning.
Do residents generally take out their own liability insurance?
I do not know the answer to that question. I would be surprised, and I don't know for this court, how, in fact, the liability issues in insurance are managed as between employers and the I do not think there's a record on it. It's the kind of thing that if the court were concerned, it would not take my answer from counsel table.
The reason I ask the question is because the issue has been framed in prior years as that the insurance premiums for physicians were out of control, and that the doctors would leave the jurisdiction and leave us helpless and hopeless because they can't afford to pay the premiums, and they'll flock to states where premiums are less. So that's my point. If the residents don't pay insurance premiums, then they're not under the public policy of limiting liability, putting on the caps. Anyway, we don't know.
I know this, that it's intuitive to me that if you expand the protection to include the first-year unlicensed residents, you're increasing protection, and likely you're not going to increase premiums, and if anything, you'll keep them as they are if that's already been accounted for, and or you're going to lower them. I mean, the fact is that these caps relate to significant, hard to quantify, and potentially significant recoveries, and what we're doing at the minimum of expanding that plain meaning definition is expanding that protection against catastrophic awards.
Is the Medical College of Wisconsin a health care provider?
The Medical College. I can't give the answer on that. I believe the answer to that is yes, but I don't know what this record shows. And I do know this, Justice Prosser, that likely those issues upon remand will have to be the subject of evidence in any event. MCRA is involved, for example, and I suspect they think they're the health care provider and therefore employee of a health care provider, but there may be issues of fact as it relates to that. And likewise, whether there is – we're going to try an employment case – each time, it seems to me, unless the court goes to what I consider to be the plain meaning here, you avoid it by simply giving meaning to healthcare provider to include someone who is clearly, admittedly, in the business of and actually delivering healthcare services at the time of his alleged act of negligence. Egregious as it may have been, there's no question as to that he was there helping with the delivery and doing his best even if it was incompetent.
Surprising it wasn't included when others who were farther away from the patient are specifically included in the listing.
You're talking about 655 listing now. Your Honor, I think 655 is not the standard here of determination. And it really, if you're reading it literally, it starts with, I think, the first two words, under this chapter, definition shall be. And that is an elaborate scheme that relates to pricing and contribution and setting up with the fund and the like.
Thank you, Mrs. Skilton. Are there further questions? Thank you, Mr. Skilton. Mr. Cannon.
Thank you. I will...
Mr. Kennett, do you want to change the disk now? We have to change the disk. As you know, these proceedings are recorded, and we've gone over time, which means our disk has to be changed.
Thank you. I'm going to address these issues in reverse order. Please don't misconstrue that as a neurological competency test, especially if I miss something. The basic background that Mr. Skilton starts on is that Dr. Lindemann is a healthcare provider under 895 sub 1, 55 sub 1 through 3. And for the basic premise, he starts with the quote from Clark versus Erdman. And in their brief at page 10, this is what it says. The term healthcare provider in 893.55 stats plainly applies to anyone who professionally provides healthcare to others. From there, he says, Dr. Lindemann therefore qualifies under that definition as a healthcare provider. What he quite cleverly forgot to mention is the sentence that follows that, which says, podiatrists do exactly that. They provide health care to others, and like other professionals, health care providers, they are licensed to practice by the State Medical Examining Board pursuant to Chapter 448 statutes. Every definition of health care provider, as this Court has interpreted it over 15 years in the Clark case to podiatry, in the Webb case to optometry, in the Ahrens case to chiropractors, in the Rip case to dentists, and in Doe to somebody who was not a health care provider, just like Dr. Lindemann, and that's why it didn't apply in that case, is you have to meet a two-pronged test. One, you have to provide health care services, and number two, you have to be licensed by the state. So
is being permitted by the state count?
Pardon?
Does being permitted by the Department of Licensing count? He had a permit by the Department of Licensing in order to work in the hospital. Does that count? He wasn't eligible for a license because he
hadn't been out of school. No, he did not have a temporary education permit. He actually didn't get that until July of 1999. He got this. This is an event that happened in November of 1998. So he had no temporary education permit.
How was he working in the hospital then without any kind of permit?
Under the MCWA program, and actually he was a little bit unusual because I think it took him 2 years to get his license in this case. I don't know why.
You're just telling me that my concern about there being a permit being comparable to a license doesn't weigh because he didn't have that either.
He didn't even have the temporary education permit. So 15 years of decisions of this court have interpreted 893.55 as requiring a two-pronged test. You have to provide health care services, and you also have to be licensed. That's the definition of physician health care provider in Chapter 655. If you go to the general definition of health care provider as it relates to a physician in 990.01 sub 28, it also defines a physician as licensed by the medical examining board under Chapter 448. And if you look at the definitions of health care provider in the statute, there's only one exception for a Christian Scientist, but absent that, every definition of health care provider in the statutes requires that you be either licensed or certified by the state. And that's a beautiful bright line because it's an objective test and everybody knows then who qualifies, and it's consistent with the 15 years of this court's decision-making. So the issue here, quite frankly, is one of looking back to the enactment of the statute. And when you look back at the enactment of the statute, we have, again, a case law saying how the statute got enacted in 1995. It was for the purpose of medical malpractice, and it was for the purpose of tying the two together. If you do a word search, the only reference outside of 893.554 itself in the statutes, the only reference that directs you there and links you there is 655.017, which directs you and tells you that's the cap on damages for medical malpractice. There was no podiatry crisis. There was no optometry crisis. There was no dental crisis. Yet Mr. Skilton would have you believe that they should all be covered under a cap, and you wouldn't get the quid pro quo. Here, we're going to cap your non-economic damages. We won't cap your economic damages. The quid pro quo is that you'll get this unlimited coverage from the bank, the Physicians Compensation Fund, or the Injured Patient and Family Fund that it's now called. I think there's an oxymoron hiding somewhere in there. They've got $750 million in the bank, so I don't think that the scare tactics that Mr. Skilton talked about are applicable. He also talked about the targeting.
And if I could, I do not pretend that this is an area of which I am proficient, so I need help. If Dr. Lindemann is not technically a licensed physician, and if, as you argue, he is not a health care provider, then how does he come under the Med-Mal liability?
He's not covered by 655.
Mr. Cannon, you have to stand in front of the microphone.
It's a general common law negligence that he has. Not per 655. General common law negligence is what he's liable under, and that's what the court ruled in this case. The scare tactics that Mr. Skilton talked about targeting these poor, unfortunate residents whom everybody concedes are not supposed to be practicing medicine by themselves, which is why Dr. Baer was never sued in this case, because he never got the call from Dr. Lindemann, nor did the senior resident get the call from Dr. Lindemann that there was a problem with Mrs. Phelps. He undertook treatment.
Counselor, I think what Justice Butler is trying to ask you is, if he's not a health care provider and he's not a licensed physician, then are you disputing that he had the right to provide health care, however poorly, to your client? Because if he didn't, you got an assault. You don't have medical malpractice.
No, I'm not disputing that.
Okay.
I'm not disputing that.
So he had a right to provide medical care. He did it poorly.
he had a right to assess the patient and report up the chain.
Right, right.
Everybody
okay.
understood that.
All right.
He exceeded his authority, as Justice Prosser stated in his question. And therefore, when you exceed that authority, that's another way that negligence should attach. But these scare tactics that Mr. Skilton is using aren't applicable. There's an order of the court in this case that Dr. Lindemann is covered under a $6 million policy of insurance. Exhibit 1 in the trial is Dr. Lindemann's employment agreement. The finding of fact was that he was employed by MCWA. They have an obligation to provide him insurance. And although it's not part of the record in this case, it is part of the record in the Hagerty case. It wasn't an issue here. But in that case, the hospital, and in this case, the hospitals also provide liability insurance for residents that are on the property. And in that case, we know from the record it's $21 million. In this case, on the issue of the who's the employer, the issue here, the court found that MCWA was the employer. They have the right to terminate. They have the employment agreement. When the issue was put early on in this case, whether or not St. Joseph's Hospital was the de facto employer, we served a request to admit on them. It's in the record 14 colon at page 134. I asked St. Joseph's when they were a defendant in the case whether they had the right to supervise and control Dr. Lindemann and whether or not they were the de facto employer of Dr. Lindemann. They denied both of those requests to admit. Dr. Lindemann did not contest either of those, so this is a red herring that they're hoping to throw it on, out on the end of a fishing pole to dangle that maybe we should have that issue resolved. They didn't raise it. They didn't pursue it. And he admitted that he was employed by MCWA and never raised the issue that he was a borrowed servant. But even if he had, St. Joe's denied that he was a borrowed servant.
Mr. Cannon, how long has the term health care provider in 893.55 been in the statute?
I think that goes back to the very beginning enactment, and, you know, that's 30-some years. The second issue.
Is this the only case against a resident?
There are very few of them. The Hagerty case, which I tried last October, is the second case that I'm aware of. I'm aware of one other resident case years ago tried by Attorney Jerry Block. These are very few and far between because everybody knows their limitations and they're actually more cautious than not in going up the chain to contact people, and therefore they end up getting off the hook, and if something has happened, it gets into somebody else's area of responsibility. But the other thing that Mr. Skilton raised is the issue of interpretation under the 1985 and 1995 definitions of health care provider, and he's now arguing for a new interpretation. Yet under Section 990.0017, a revised statute is to be understood in the same sense as the original unless the change in language indicates a different meaning so clearly as to preclude judicial construction. In the Fuchsberger-Gruber case in 2001, this court said it is axiomatic that a statute does not abrogate a rule of common law unless the abrogation is clearly expressed and leaves no doubt of the legislature's intent. So I think he's taken everything out of context and he's taken it out from a premise that Dr. Lindemann should become a health care provider simply because he's providing health care services, but this court has held there's a two-pronged test. He didn't give you the benefit of the rest of the quote, the very next sentence in Clark. And so I think his argument has no underlying logical basis. On the standard of care issue, I know maybe the inference that perhaps Judge Fine didn't want to accept was that maybe Judge Sullivan, by finding that Dr. Lindemann was negligent under either standard of care, thought that he was trying to make the appeal bulletproof. But in fact, that wasn't the case. It was a shorthand way of saying even Dr. Lindemann's experts came in and testified he was not negligent as a first-year resident, but they ultimately admitted on cross-examination that he was negligent, causally so, and not going up the chain and getting others involved, Dr. Brookhuizen and Dr. Clark, and then, of course, all of the other experts testified that he was negligent. So I think that's the issue that maybe got Judge Fine started on, but it wasn't done for the purpose of making his appeal bulletproof. It was done because that's what the testimony was in this case. They suggest that perhaps now we'll make a trial strategy of targeting these poor residents. That's not the fact either. Any lawyer who would try to stretch the facts and make somebody a target who, in fact, was not a target is going to end up losing that case. In both this case and in the Hagerty case, the only physician who saw the patient in both of those cases was the resident. And in both of those cases, the patient went downhill and became a catastrophic case because the physician didn't follow common sense and the policies and procedures that he had been following for 3 years to go up the chain of command. He exceeded his authority to treat her in an obstetrical, as an obstetrician would. He exceeded his authority, and that's why he was negligent.
Mr. Cannon, I'm letting you go over because we let the others go over, too. So, but we would like you to conclude your argument.
Thank you.
Again.
One more issue on their standard of care and what they really want to do, and I think this Court asked very probative questions about how do you have a bright line on what the standard of care is. Do you divide it between first years and then the upper residents, second through four or second through five, depending on what residency program they're in? Or do you do it on the basis of their skill and knowledge and experience at the time that they provide the treatment? They have cited a case, which, by the way, the majority of jurisdictions that have addressed this issue have uniformly held, as we have already held in Wisconsin, that there's only two standards, the average physician and then the specialist. But they cite the case of Butler versus HCA Health Insurance, where they actually didn't discuss the standard of care applicable to a resident. But in that case, it involved a fifth-week resident. And what they really want to try to do is get a line from you that they can then say, well, based on his experience and skill at the time, now you've got to have a standard for a fifth-week resident, a 15th-day resident, a six-month resident. You know, you don't teach, when you become a resident, they don't teach you a lower standard of care the first year, and then the second year say, oh, everything we taught you the first year, we were only kidding, forget it. You have to reach this standard of care. They only teach one standard of care. And a lot of it is basic common sense medicine. And so when you have just two classes, the average physician and a specialist, that's a bright line. That's workable. It's worked in this state forever. To put now different nuances, is he an average physician? Is he a little bit dimmer than an average physician? Is he brighter than an average physician? You're now going to have all these different nuances. You're going to get right into the situation where the burden of the mistake of the resident, of the physician, is on the patient who did nothing. So I thank you. One last thing on the jury. Okay, I'll make it really short. This is not the first time this Court has addressed the issue of jury fee waivers. 814.61 says if the jury fee is not paid, no jury may be called. The case law, Prentice, the jury fee was paid 1 day late. The plaintiff or the defendant in that case charged a constitutional violation. This Court said that jury fee waiver is expressly authorized by statute, Article 1, Section 5. A jury trial may be waived by the parties in all the cases in the manner prescribed by law. A one-day waiver, this Court said, there is no constitutional right in manner or time in which the right may be exercised, and any discrepancy of time payment limits for the jury trial are not invidious discrimination. And in State versus Graf, I'm going to close with this. The prepayment of jury fees and other costs as a condition for a jury trial was not a violation of the Wisconsin Constitution's preservation of the right to a jury trial. If you don't continue to have that bright line here, you don't pay it on time, you're gone, then you're going to have lawyers treating virtually every order of the court and every statute as the exception becoming the rule. The exception will swallow the rule. And in this case, they didn't meet any of the criteria or any of the procedures set forth in the statutes for preserving that right, and they tried to pull a fast one, laying in the weeds until they got caught. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cannon. Thank you, Mr. Van Sicklen, and you, Mr. Skilton, for your excellent arguments today in yet another medical malpractice case to come before this Court. That ends our hearing in 03-0580, Phelps v. Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin, Inc. The Court's in recess until its next March oral argument in mid-month. The Court will meet in the conference room at 3:30. We are in recess.